This is On Target St. John's. A look at politics, crime, education. What's happening here with the people who know? The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station. Now, your On Target St. John's host, Linda Swain.
Everyone, On Target St. John's, the first one of the week, and we've got an interesting one for you today. Biology professor at Memorial University, Steve Carr, has been doing some interesting work of late. He's the founder of Terra Nova Genomics, and he's on the phone with me from outside. Hello, Steve.
Good afternoon, Linda. It's quite wonderful. I think it's the first too much information, but first radio interview that I've done with my shirt off, because there's such an opportunity to get some rays. The Newfoundland right. That doesn't come so often.
Indeed. And while we contemplate that for a moment, you've been doing some really interesting work as of late with the Miapikak First Nation in Con River. History tells us the last known Beothuk, Shannon Dithit, died in 1929, but you've discovered that the genetic markers related to the Beothuk may exist to this day. Tell us what you found.
Well, there was a paper, it was published back in 2017 out of McMaster University, and as it happens, the senior author on that was a former honors student of mine who has gone on to do very great work. And that was an examination of complete mitochondrial DNA sequences from a series of Beothuk and maritime archaic archaeological digs, actually including Nenasabiset and Temasdui as historical persons. And they did the analysis of those sequences, and their principal determination was that the maritime archaic and the Beothuk were not especially closely related. So that the maritime archaic did not give rise to the Beothuk that succeeded them on the island. Now, the question that occurred to me was, given this question that's raised, it often comes up in Newfoundland, is are there any descendants of the Beothuks still living? I took the sequences that were in Anna's paper and went to a database called GenBank, and GenBank includes all of the DNA sequences that anybody has ever determined. And I couldn't tell you how large that database is, but it's huge. And it's got a search capacity where it allows you to say, well, I have here a sequence. I'd like to know if there's anything similar in the database. And so I did what we call a meta-analysis, and I simply took the sequences that were in Dr. Duggan's database, and I put them into the database, and I looked for the most closely similar individual in amongst the modern people that were in the database. And the short answer is that, to my surprise, we found one individual who is genetically identical to Nenasabiset, another individual who is identical to a maritime archaic person, and another individual who is as similar to Temasdui as are other members of the family, in air quotes, of the family of which Temasdui is part. So the tentative conclusion that I draw is, yes, indeed, maritime archaic and Beothuk sequences persist to the present day. How widely they persist is the subject of our ongoing research, but it proves what the oral tradition of people such as the Mi'kmaq, Chief Joe, have always said, which is that there were friendly relationships between all of these people, and those friendly relationships have produced offspring that are still with us.
So identical to Nenasabiset, what does that mean exactly?
Identical to Nenasabiset means if you took the 16,569 A, C, G's, and T's in his DNA sequence and lined them up with this particular individual, every one of those 16,569 bases would be identical. So it's the degree of relationship that you would expect between a mother and a daughter, and typically between a daughter and a grandmother. And those sequences evolve over time. They change by changes in the DNA sequence. But the fact that this particular lineage, which we knew existed in 1829, still exists in 2020, that's where the identity comes in. That lineage of which Nona Sabasett was a part, the Red Indian the Red Indian Lake band. Exaggerating a little bit, that band still exists. I take that back. Those lineages still exist.
That's fascinating, because we've often said, Newfoundlanders and Labradorians and the Mi'kmaq have often said, you know, there exists today, there was intermarriage at some point in history. Of course, the records don't always prove that. It's very difficult to find that bit of proof. But now you've found some. Did this individual know anything about a Beothuk past?
No, and this was one of the interesting things. This particular individual had an active interest in genealogy, and because of the way that this person listed their sequence in the database, I was able to go through the testing company that had done the test. And they put me in touch with the person, making sure, and I wanted to respect his privacy, and if he didn't want to talk to me, that would be fine. But he was very anxious to talk to me, and what I know, and I've given the pronoun away, so that he's aware of his maternal ancestry back five generations, and there's no indication of a Native American or indigenous person that they know of. He's very interested in it. He will be pursuing things. And I'll just point out that five generations probably doesn't take us back into the early 1800s or perhaps the early 1700s, which is probably where we'd have to go to find a common ancestor. So the Beothuk DNA has spread beyond what we think of the Beothuk. The other interesting thing that arises out of this is where we find a number of Nona Sabasets, Nona Sabasett himself and a number of his relatives is in the present-day Ojibwe tribe, which is currently settled around the Great Lakes, especially around Lake Superior. And again, what we know from oral tradition, but also in this case from written tradition on birch bark, is that the Mi'kmaq had early contacts with the Europeans. The Europeans apprised their brothers, the Ojibwe, that you might want to get out while the getting out is good, and assisted them in moving westward, that there are birch bark records of that movement. And I would suggest, as I've discussed with Chief, and Chief agrees, that those written records are at least as good as the Vinland sagas, because you know that Europeans make things up, so you can't always trust those oral traditions of the Europeans.
No, indeed, and as you know, as a professor, that a lot of things that are written down are simply a guide, I guess, in some cases, may provide you hints or may send you in a completely wrong direction when it comes to that sort of thing, especially when you're talking about things that could be a couple of hundred years old.
Well, the advantage is when we have, as we do with the Miapapek First Nations, we have a very well worked out genealogy. Because it's important to the community, and that's as accurate as anything that we're going to get. It's based on the church records remembering that the Miapotec converted to Catholicism around 1600, and that there were marriages that were documented between French sailors who had jumped ship on the French shore. So we've got a very good documentation there, and that's where we hope to be able to consolidate that with what we found about the Beothuk and the Mi'kmaq, and that's the point of the National Geographic study, which is ongoing, however, on hold because of pandemic.
Indeed. The gentleman in question, the one you're talking about now, you said he had no known indigenous female along the female line going back five generations. Does he have indigenous connections that he knew of?
None at all that he knows of. And he's very, very into this. We had a couple of very long chats about all this. I have stoutly refused to give out his name to preserve his privacy. But this just shows that, genealogy, relationships amongst people are very complicated. Very, very few groups, indigenous or otherwise, are where they were now 500 years ago at the time of European contact, or even 1,000 years ago, if you believe the Vinland saga. So people have moved around. When they move around, they take their genes with them, and they have past histories of interactions. There are all traditions about those, and it's a complicated story to pick through.
Well, indeed, and it looks like the Mi'kmaq might be that common thread sort of connecting all of this. What have you been able to find through your work with the Miapotec First Nation?
Well, we got the money to do the Mi'kmaq study in late December of last year. I was all set to go down. Snowmageddon hit. I think I would still be in Gander if I had tried that trip. And then we arranged for another trip. And the pandemic lockdown has occurred, and the Con River is very tightly closed for good reasons, and I don't want to go down there or go on with the work until things are safe, and more importantly, the community that I'm working with believes that it's safe and understands that what we are doing is safe. So
you haven't actually gotten into the real meat and potatoes of the research work yet.
No, this has been the very frustrating thing, is that we and it also shows you something about how science works, which is that we know about the connection between the Ojibwe, which are also called the Chippewa. We know about the connection between them and the Beothuk simply because somebody happens to have done a study of the Ojibwe community in the Great Lakes. And so a genetic record is there. And we don't know any details about the Mi'kmaq Beothuk connection simply because nobody has done that study, and that we will be the first, and I should say the Miapotec First Nation is going to be the first to know about its genetic relationships with past people, because these studies are not they're not very widely done in First Nations or Indigenous communities for a variety of reasons.
Steve Carr, a biology professor with Memorial University and founder of Terra Nova Genomics, is my guest on Target St. John's today. Hopefully he's got his sunblock on. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
My guest today, out enjoying the sunshine, is biology professor at Memorial University and founder of Terra Nova Genomics, Steve Carr. And he's found some intriguing information on the Beothuk. Steve, you and I have chatted before about this. It's a fascinating topic, and a lot of Newfoundlanders and Labradorians are fascinated by it. Until recently, there was no full Beothuk genome. What's changed?
What has changed is the technology. That we had done some work in my lab a number of years ago where the only thing that you could recover from remains that had been in the ground for hundreds or in some case thousands of years was very short pieces of DNA. And those would be sufficient to assign somebody to what technically we'd call it a haplogroup. And we could also just say that that's to a lineage. So we could say that somebody belonged to one of the five characteristic lineages of a First Nations Indigenous peoples, which are called A, B, C, D, and X. What has come about now is that it is routinely possible to obtain complete DNA sequences from good material that's even 50,000 or a million years old. Several Neanderthal genomes have been recovered. The Denisovans, who are very early humans that are found in Central Asia.
From that tiny little fingertip bone.
Yes. Yeah. So you can get enough DNA out of a tooth. You can get enough DNA out of the inside of a bone. And with the biotic and the maritime, using the proper techniques, you can get the DNA out intact. You can obtain a complete sequence, and the complete sequence is essential to making the kinds of determinations that I was able to make in this paper, which is that this individual is not just similar to, but is actually identical to, and then beyond that, as we've talked about, similarity and relationship are not exactly the same thing. So we are not looking in this case for descendants of Nana Sabasat. We know that he and Damazdui had one child who was murdered. So we are not looking for their descendants, but we are looking for their cousins. So this this fellow down in the States, it's not that he is a descendant, but it's that he may have had a common father or grandfather or great grandfather or great grandfather. And this is one of the variables in the study. It's not really possible yet to say, well, how far back did they share a common ancestor?
So this isn't mitochondrial, then.
This is mitochondrial.
Oh,
well,
it is.
And this is also for the that we looked at the mitochondrial DNA because that was what was available from 2017, and the ability to recover complete human nuclear, the nuclear genome, so the stuff where you get one chromosome from mom and one chromosome from dad, that's also possible, and that is being done. It's not being done by me, but it is being done. So we're going to have a very, very precise comparison between the Beothuk, the Maritime, Archaic, and the Miapikak First Nation. So we'll be able to get a very, very precise measurement of relationship. So it's not just similarity, and you'd have to take my course, but it's relationship, and we're looking at basically cousins. And the question that arises is, well, are you a first cousin, a second cousin, a third cousin? And if you've gone to any of the commercial companies, that's the kind of questions that they're typically able to answer. But in our case, working with the company and working with some of the experts in the field, we'll be able to get very, very, very precise gene genealogies between living persons and ancient persons, and that's where the real excitement of this is going to come in.
So this gentleman we're talking about now, whatever connection there is, must have occurred in a certain time frame, so beyond the five generations he's traced back, and yet after the time of, I guess, a European and indigenous connection at some point.
Mm-hmm. The interesting thing that happens here, and we had the same case in the paper that Angela Pope did more than 10 years ago now, is we had from a general library of DNAs that came from early settlers of Newfoundland. There was a woman who called herself French, and she was from the Port-au-Port Peninsula. And all of this is material that she had given permission to be used. I don't know her name. I don't know anything more about her than what's in the record. But she had a First Nations mitochondrial DNA. And so the inference is that, well, there was a Mi'kmaq woman who married a French sailor. I'm going to guess it's as good a story as any. They were both Catholic. That they had a daughter. That daughter at some point was taken into the French community. There's also the possibility that she was in the Mi'kmaq community. There's a word that's not very nice that's used for people between the two groups. But as long as she had a daughter, and the daughter had a daughter, and the daughter had a daughter, and as long as that, and you can say that as many times as you like, so long as that maternal chain is unbroken, the First Nations mitochondrial DNA type is going to persist into the current generation. And this could happen long after any detectable trace. Now I'm thinking in my mind, do I really mean that? Because that's kind of what we're looking for. But it'll persist long after ordinary tests would be unable to detect any fraction of indigenous DNA.
Well, indeed, because if I had, let's say, a Portuguese great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, it may not show in my DNA.
That's right. Because it is, even supposing there was such a thing as Portuguese DNA, quote unquote, it would be diluted, for lack of a better word, by one half in the first generation, then by a half of a half after two generations. And when you've gone through five generations of that, then you're down to one part in 32. And for the way things are typically done, that is the limit on being able to say yes, we have somebody has an association with a particular ethnic group. Now, the advantage of the way that we're going to do it is we won't be looking at fractions of the total genome, but we'll be looking at individual markers. Choosing my words carefully, this is why one of the things that's possible to do now is that there are genetic markers that are characteristic of the Neanderthal people. And it is possible to detect those particular markers in modern humans, even though we haven't had a common ancestor in 50,000 years. So I myself am about 1.5% Neanderthal, which some people would say, well, that shows.
Perhaps more now out in the sun. I don't know.
Yes, it could be needing to get more sun. But I'll give you another example. And again, sticking that this is a genetic story and not anything else. But we have Santu Toni, who is very famous in Newfoundland as being the daughter of a Beothuk man. Some years after the Beothuk were supposed to have gone extinct. Now, I discussed in the paper, and this is not to doubt her story, but if you accept her story as stated, well, if she had a Beothuk father and a Mi'kmaq mother, then, of course, her mitochondrial DNA is going to be Beothuk. So we don't expect to see any relationship between her mitochondrial DNA and those of the Beothuk that we know about.
Right. You mean Mi'kmaq, her mitochondrial DNA.
That her mitochondrial sequence would be Mi'kmaq. And so we would not expect any special connection between her and her Beothuk father. And, of course, being a woman, she did not inherit his Y chromosome, which would have been a Beothuk Y chromosome. So we have actually has neither of the two markers, would have had neither of the two markers that are easy to look at. And then any of her offspring, again, that relentless one half of one half. If we could trace her offspring, which I don't believe we can, I'll defer to some of my friends to tell me that. But it would be one is not going to find those traces. So it's to some extent the luck of the draw. You have to find somebody who is the daughter of a daughter of a daughter of a daughter of a daughter. And if that chain is interrupted once, well, then the mitochondrial link is lost. But even if we lose that link, it's still possible using the nuclear DNA that we will use in the National Geographic study. It's still possible to trace those markers, as we say, in the present population.
That proverbial needle in the haystack.
Getting a needle in the haystack is actually extremely easy, because what you do is back up a electromagnet to the haystack, and you turn it on, and it pulls out everything that's made out of metal in the haystack. And I've used this analogy a lot, because you're going to get the needle, and you're going to get a lot of stuff that has nothing to do with the needle, but is equally of interest. And for example, something that a lot of people don't know is the U.S. during World War II made pennies out of steel rather than copper, as everybody used to, and that those coins were used in Newfoundland. And that they're actually a lot more abundant in Newfoundland than they are other places, because they just got diluted out of circulation. Yes, you could look for the needle in a haystack, and you could find a 1943 U.S. steel penny. And wouldn't that be fun? Wouldn't that be fun?
Or anything else for that matter. Steve Carr is our guest today on Target St. John's. So we're talking about some of the work he's been doing in trying to locate biothic DNA. And a very interesting conversation indeed. We'll be back right after this.
Now back to Linda Swain on Target St. John's on VOCM.
Professor of Biology at Memorial University and founder of Terra Nova Genomics, Steve Carr is my guest today on Target St. John's. And you mentioned earlier, Steve, and I'll ask you this very quickly, this gentleman we've been talking about who has this identical marker as Nonasabasut, does he have connections to Newfoundland and Labrador somewhere?
None that he knows of. I haven't wanted to inquire too closely. He is a very knowledgeable about genealogy, and as much as we would like to, we've not been able to establish any sort of leads on a connection. And again, what he knows is five generations back. His people are in the I'm going to stop there so I don't give away personal information. But five generations back, there's nothing to indicate that. A throwaway comment when you're really grasping at straws rather than at needles. There is a tradition in that part of the state that he lives that the people in that community are of mixed ancestry. And genetic studies that have been done of that group don't indicate, they haven't found anything yet, which is not to say that it's true, it's just that they haven't found anything yet, and he's not really connected with that. So one is always hoping, as a scientist, I'm not hoping for anything, but I'm data-driven. And one of the things that I should say in all of this, and I keep emphasizing it, is that everything that we've found so far is based on the individuals that we know of. So when we talk about genetic variation in the biothic, this is based on a total of 14 individuals scattered over several thousand years. When I look at their relationships, I would say, yes, this seems to be reasonably complete but were we to find another individual, that individual might be a member of a lineage that we don't know about yet.
We know precious little about the Beothuk as a culture. We don't know much about their migrations or where, you know, they regularly came back and forth from. So it's, you know, theoretically, I suppose it's possible that Nona Sabusut or his family may have come to the island more recently than others.
Yes, and when you look at the data, and this is where you take my advanced course, there's all kinds of technical considerations that we have to incorporate as possibilities. An interesting story that I'm trying to follow up with the researchers that did this is that in Iceland, there are several families whose birth records in Iceland trace back to the 1750s, and they have mitochondrial DNA sequences that are clearly indigenous Native American, but they are of a type that has never been seen in exactly that form amongst indigenous Native Americans. And given that it's Iceland, scientists who don't speculate, the temptation is to say that, well, one source of that could be if the Norse settlers at Lansometo, contrary to what's said on the Vinland, where the colony was withdrawn in less than 100 years, there was no intermarriage. There's nothing about women theft, that if they in fact did take women back to Iceland, and if the women had a daughter, that would be one way to account for that. But those particular genotypes that we find in Iceland are not like exactly any of the genotypes that we see in the Beothuk. But here again, the next Beothuk that we found might be a match there, or somebody that we reveal in the Mi'kmaq or other peoples in the current study, they might match that particular person. And I've said this would set the cat amongst the pigeons. But these are the kinds of surprises that make the work interesting. It also means that you have to write, well, that's what we thought then, and this is what we think now. But all of these things are possible. The very next person that you look at may change the story entirely. That we know, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of mitochondrial DNA sequences there are in the database. It's a huge number, but it's only a small fraction of all the lineages that have ever lived. Lineages that were present amongst the Beothuk 1,000 years ago, if they were in contact with the Vinland colony, those may have passed out of existence naturally. And all it takes is that daughter has a son as an only child, and that lineage is gone. It's a sure bet that anybody who is alive today has ancestors, but it's also pretty much of a sure bet that any particular person who lived 1,000 years ago very likely does not have descendants. And it's just the way the math works out. Some of the familiar examples are that there are no descendants of Abraham Lincoln.
Indeed.
Maternal Steve, or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid we have to leave it there. It's been a fascinating conversation. We didn't even get into the maritime archaic connections that you found. One quick question, very fast. We have people reaching out and saying, how can I do DNA Beothuk testing?
The study with the National Geographic study is limited by the terms of the grant to enrolled members of the Miapikak First Nation. And so this is the message that I have been sending out. Having said that, I remain interested in, for example, the Qualipu First Nation, but the chief has emphasized very strongly that we need to get the Miyabakuk First Nation defined first, and then we'll go on to the broader questions.
Indeed. Not quite there yet. Steve Carr, fascinating conversation. Appreciate your time. Enjoy the sun. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Linda. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everyone. Fascinating show.